It's Wednesday, September 20th, 2023, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Luke Pizzo. On our program this week, after 15 years and a lot of hard work, Mexican journalist Emilio Gutierrez Soto gets asylum in the United States. Rolling Stone founder Jan Wenner axed from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame after comments about black musicians and women. And it's the band everyone loves to hate, Nickelback. We're going to talk about the new documentary that was commissioned by the band. But we're going to start first with Kristen Welker's Meet the Press debut on Sunday morning on NBC. It was billed as an hour of must-see TV, a sit-down interview with Donald Trump. You can watch that full interview on NBC's website, and you can see when you do that it's a one-hour 18-minute volley between the former president and former White House correspondent. She worked in a bunch of topics in that time, from the indictments against him to January 6th, to abortion, to Ukraine, to the economy. There were moments when he steamrolled her, refusing to answer questions and talking right over her, and moments when she gave it right back to him and fact-checked him in real time as needed. And I get wanting to get a big name for the first show, and Biden and the Biden administration turned them down. Was Trump the move?
Well, second prize is a two-hour sit-down interview. I mean, I just felt so sorry for Kristen Welker when I heard this, and I thought, you know, what a way.
Sorry to, in what way?
Well, because it's a no-win situation. I think we've talked about this before, that, you know, we in the journalism business operate according to certain norms, and those norms are assuming that our sources are going to abide by certain norms, like trying to tell the truth in most cases, or trying to at least not obfuscating, answering the question, and having a certain professional courtesy in dealing with members of the press. Trump doesn't do that. His refusal to do it over and over again means that he is, he's a disruptive force who is impossible to interview, and it is impossible to maintain a level playing field there. And you end up platforming somebody who's a demagogue and a liar, and the journalist can't win. So that's why I felt sorry for her.
I felt like she did as good of a job as one can do in many ways under those circumstances in picking her battles, pushing back, as well as the layering of different fact-checking that they did on top of that mm-hmm. interview afterward. I'm not sure what else you can do, but as you said, Kathy, I don't think there's a way to win under those circumstances. And so while I think that it was about as good of a package as you could have put together under those circumstances, there just isn't a place where that's going to set her up to succeed. And I think it's particularly difficult for a venerable program like that to adjust enough to meet the demands of this kind of off-the-wall candidate.
Meet the Press is the kind of avatar of journalistic mm-hmm. yeah. norms, right? You know, and so, you have a new host who is trying to set a tone, and you just throw this big orange banana peel underneath her feet. Well, I just think it was a terrible thing to do.
What did I think and what do I see for this as the future of Meet the Press? And I said, I don't know. Ask me on Monday, or ask me a week from Monday, or 2 weeks from Monday. I don't think we can really say that this was the true beginning of the Kristen Welker era.
No way, because when you put Donald Trump on a platform like that, it's all about Donald Trump. It is not about the interviewer. And, you know, just to be clear to our listeners, I don't think that, you know, this isn't a matter of like, we want the journalist to look good, or we just want a decent interview where there's some normalcy. And you just don't get that with Donald Trump. You don't. And so is it wise to try to put him on a platform like this and expect to get anything more than what you got, which is talking over mm-hmm. somebody, telling a lot of lies that have to be fact-checked on air. It's like the little Dutch boy. You know, you might plug 15 holes, but then you get dumped on by the 16th, right, that you missed because there are just so many lies that you can't possibly keep up with them. It's really a difficult assignment for a journalist.
It's also a historic one, right? And this was a big moment for women, for people of color. The idea that Meet the Press, again, this venerable outlet, this avatar for journalism, that we're seeing that that there's a greater sense of inclusion at that table and who's going to be running that table going forward.
Oh, it's huge. And that's why I think it was so, did we really have to muck it up with Donald Trump? Which to me is pandering for ratings.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of like, could you, and I honestly, Amy, I wondered to myself, if this were a guy, would that guy have taken that assignment and would that guy have been free to refuse the assignment? Because if
the
it had been me,
yes. Is the assignment. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because it really does throw a lot of shade on that. What as you pointed out, is a very historic moment. It's really an important moment for journalism because we are including more people at the table and showing that women and people of color have a place at really what has been an important voice and really an agenda setter for journalism. So it's great, but to overshadow that with this kind of no-win interview situation, I think was really unfortunate.
It seems unfair to her in so many ways and unfair to the folks who I think are looking to get genuine information about this repeat election, especially having someone on who didn't really have anything new to talk about in those moments. I think it's different if there's a particularly newsworthy reason to bring someone back in that sense, but that didn't seem to be the case, and there didn't seem to be anything broken news-wise over the course of the interview, which again, I think is another indicator that it may not have been the best choice for that first round.
Okay, so this next thing, it wasn't like it happened overnight. The writing was on the wall from the moment that the New York Times company bought The Athletic. And it was formally announced in July. Still, it didn't make it any less, well, weird when the New York Times hit newsstands yesterday without a dedicated sports section. The last sports section was published in the New York Times on Monday, and it was a really emotional day for staffers who held a protest walking through the newsroom and picketing outside the building.
This is, and I think I'm speaking to this more personally, right?
Yeah.
This is a sad day because the folks that I think of as the platonic ideals of sports journalism are people like George Vesey, Bill Roden, who not only are exceptionally good writers, but help us understand both the sports and the meaning culturally of those sports in ways that I don't think the average sports journalist has the time and space to be able to do. And so to see the loss of the institution that's nurtured that many folks for decades and decades and decades is frustrating. Mm-hmm. I was a former competitive figure skater and coach for many, many years, more than half my life. And I still look to Yuri Longman and Juliet McCour as folks who are covering those sports at a level that is much, much higher than the kind of normal Olympic drop in journalism, unfortunately, where we only
you fly
see
into
in
whatever
time.
City the Olympics are
exactly.
in, and nobody cares about Olympic sports outside of that.
These are among the very, very few people who, as an insider in that sport, I care about what their opinions are of what we're saying. And so, again, I just don't feel like most news outlets have the resources to dedicate that kind of time to that type of sports journalism. And so it's a challenge and a sad day to see that lost.
Well, in this, I saw it described in one of the pieces, it's on our Lynx blog, that in a year when the Yankees are stinking out the place, the Mets ownership has even given up on the Mets. Now the New York Times' sports section goes away, which is the gut punch, and this is how it was written in this piece, for the literate sports fans of the New York region, that this really was a sports section that went beyond what you needed to know for your fantasy league or, the barroom coverage or conversations that are had in sports and among sports fans.
Well, the fact is, most sports pages tended to be, at most newspapers, I think, tended to be the place where the better writers went because you had more freedom. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of really great sports journalism being done out there. I think what's striking here, this was a business decision, mm-hmm. and it was a way to get rid of union workers. Mm-hmm. The sports section of the New York Times is, they're guild writers, they are organized by the Communications Workers of America, and the athletic writers are not. And so this is something we've seen in the past. We saw it early on in the internet era when the Washington Post had WashingtonPost.com, which was across the river from the Washington Post, mm-hmm. because those people weren't unionized. And it is also a move towards verticals, which I certainly saw that was happening at USA Today when I was there, where the idea was we'll spin off the sports section because that has a certain audience. The problem with that, I think, is that the great thing about the newspaper is, as it was traditionally conceived, was it was a place where you could find news and you could find sports and you could find culture and people could come together. And the nice thing is you might not think you were a sports fan, but you read a really beautifully written piece about figure skating mm-hmm. or a boxing match and you would find yourself captivated by it. In a world of verticals, how are people going to serendipitously find those stories? And I think that's one of the big losses and one that we in the business have mm-hmm. to come to grips with and figure out how to fix that.
I think, unfortunately, while The Athletic is able to provide resources toward in-depth reporting in sports, so there isn't necessarily a loss in terms of volume, they're based so much on a content creation model that I feel like you do lose quality. There's no way not to lose quality. There's no way not to lose insight. And again, without the protections of unionized staff, right, there's a freedom that is lost as well.
Yeah, I think it's a blow. It's a blow to the New York Times.
Okay. Speaking of freedom that was lost, I love a good segue. He doesn't know how I can sometimes capitalize on those. Speaking of freedom, Kathy, this next story was one that had us busting at the seams last week because you knew about it, but it was information that was under embargo. We're excited to share the news that Emilio Gutierrez Soto won his 15-year battle for asylum in the United States. Tell us about his case, about its development, and what this means now.
Well, this was a big deal for me because I personally have worked on this case for 6 years. And of course, as you mentioned, for Emilio, it's been a 15-year saga. And, you know, this is a case that I think really highlights how messed up our immigration system is. This is a journalist from Mexico who reported on corruption in his hometown, a small town called Asuncion in northern Mexico, and for that reason was harassed by the military and threatened with death. These are not threats that you take idly in Mexico, which is the most dangerous country for journalists outside of a war zone. And so he left with his then teenage son, came to the U.S. border to a port of entry, and requested asylum. So he came in here legally. And that began a really long saga, too long to narrate here, but it involved two periods of detention for him. And it just was so difficult, even though he had the support of the Committee to Protect Journalists, Reporters Without Borders, the National Press Club. And we ended up, when I was helping the National Press Club, we ended up recruiting a law clinic at Rutgers to file a habeas corpus case to get him out. And the Bishop of El Paso was pleading for him. And the fact that it took that much and 15 years to get justice for what should be a really clear-cut case, I think says a lot, not only about the threats facing journalists, but also what is wrong with our immigration system? Why aren't we putting all those resources on battling drug dealers and not trying to keep a journalist out of this country? It's insane.
Yeah. I feel like, especially with the increasing threats to journalism, you know, to journalists and their safety throughout the world, right? It's an important issue, and I hope that the novelty or the news value of his finally getting that after 15 years is able to open some more eyes in that direction.
You know, the other thing I would say is that if you want secure borders, which is the politics of immigration is what makes this so difficult. But if you want secure borders, support journalism, because the corruption that is driving so many people to leave their homes in Central America and in Mexico and in some southern South American countries, it's corruption. Mm-hmm. And that's what the journalists are trying to expose. And if you make it impossible for them to do that by giving them no exit, then the border situation gets worse.
Let alone give people the opportunity to come in legally and have a fair case rather than
that
having
gets
to get
decided
to other means.
In a reasonable amount of time.
Exactly.
Yes.
So as we move on to our next topic, I'm going to kind of point to what Margaret Sullivan writes for The Guardian, that it's not shocking, or I'm sorry, it is shocking. It's not surprising. Jan Wenner, the founder of Rolling Stone magazine, has been removed from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This happened after a New York Times story Friday in which Wenner was talking about his new book, which features interviews with seven iconic musicians: Bono, Bob Dylan, Jerry Garcia, Mick Jagger, John Lennon, Bruce Springsteen, and Pete Townsend. Seven white men. When he was asked and really pressed about why he only included interviews with seven white men, Wenner said that black and female musicians didn't, and this is his words, not mine, didn't articulate at the level of white musicians. The thing is here, though, racism and sexism in the music industry, it isn't a secret, and it hasn't been one going back to the height of Motown and straight through to today. But it also begs the question that if this is the attitude and the approach of the founder, or begs the question, if this is the attitude of the host, of the founder, how many people have been passed over or lost out on opportunities because they missed out on the sphere of influence that was Rolling Stone?
It was really frustrating to read this article, mm-hmm. and frustrating from the perspective of a music fan, frustrating from the perspective of a PR person.
Talk about that perspective part. Who has been there when clients have been there. Let's hear it. We don't often get the PR people's perspective sitting at this table, so we're gonna hit you up on a lot of those.
It was interesting in the first half of that interview. He talked a lot about how, in the interviews he conducted for the book, that he let his subjects review things and clean up mistakes. I found that wildly ironic in light of what's happened. And so you could imagine that when you're prepping someone for an interview like that, that's an obvious question that in this day and age a good journalist is going to ask. You need to have a good answer. And to me, at a certain point, the answer is probably something like, these were my good friends, and these are historic interviews, and these are all people who have earned their way through. That's not to make... I still think that that's a problem for the book personally, but that's the answer that you give. And it's not a complicated one. And it's still problematic, but that's the truth.
The other thing that really shocked me was it was clear that somebody in the editing process had flagged this problem for Wenner and said, dude, you don't have any women or people of color in this mix because... It mentioned, I think, in the interview that he addressed it even in the foreword of the book. So it was on his radar screen that, and here I'm talking about the omission of women and people of color, not the letting people doctor their interviews. But he knew that was out there.
How does
and
he know?
Why would you not be better prepared?
Right,
I mean, what would you tell as a PR person?
Right.
What would you tell a person going into an interview with the New York Times to say? I mean, how would you prep them for that?
Because clearly you would have anticipated the question.
Yes.
It's in the book. So he knows it's a problem.
you have to I think you come back to what's the rationale for Rolling Stone being the way it was then? And I think you frame it as part of the past, and this is, since a lot of those interviews are historic anyway, it's an artifact. And history doesn't have to include everything all of the time. And so that's my best answer. I still don't like it.
And that's still an answer as a journalist I would have accepted.
Yeah.
With the addition of, and just wait for volume two.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, because he has content to write how many other books where it could be seven women. It could be seven bands or musicians who are black. It could then be a fourth volume of Latinx musicians. Like, there's enough, again, as a historical artifact.
Right.
Go ahead. I'll let you keep going.
And in the interview, he even mentioned, he said, well, you know, I wouldn't want to do it just for PR. Right? I wouldn't want to include them just because PR thinks it's a good idea, which I found incredibly insulting. That obviously, like, this is a PR problem because it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is a history of leaving people out. And again, I think in a sense, I'm glad that we know that this is how Rolling Stone was run for a long time. And I think that gives us some space from which to reevaluate things. And it shows us where some of those blind spots have been. Not to say that Rolling Stone hasn't done great writing in a lot of ways over many, many, many decades, right? They're still an important venue, but it undermines a lot of what we see and a lot of the prioritization of certain artists that, again, it has excluded people for decades.
Yes, and I think that's a great point, that it really highlights that. The other thing is, but speaking of handling a PR crisis, Wenner's son immediately repudiated what his dad said. I mean, said, I love him very much, but no, because the son is now running Rolling Stone. And so he can't have that on his plate. And so, yeah, I mean.
I wasn't surprised to see the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame do what they did. Yeah.
How do they not?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so when I first asked Luke last week if he'd be on the show with us today, I told him one of the things I was going to want to talk about was the announcements from both Bill Maher and Drew Barrymore that they were going to return to the air this week with new episodes of their talk shows. Since then, both have announced a change in plans. Bill Maher saying on X, formerly known as Twitter, that he was holding off now that there are negotiations scheduled again in that writer's strike. Barrymore issued an apology on Instagram for planning to move ahead with production and crossing the picket lines. Now, there had been several protests there, and she, I'm guessing, upon some advice from very skilled PR professionals such as you, not you personally in this case, but those who share in your profession, probably gave them some advice that the repercussions could be a whole lot stronger than the win in their eyes of getting back on the air.
We're certainly at a period of high ebb, I think, for union organizing in the country, which I think is a fantastic thing. In a lot of different areas, you know, we have the automotive strikes right now. Being from Michigan, those are also, you know, that's union activity that I watch very closely.
Of course.
And I think that reflects this broader public sentiment and awareness coming out of the pandemic that, you know, people's work lives matter. People need to have an understanding of how that fits holistically into their well-being. And that brings up all of these different aspects of things that unions have been at the forefront of for more than 100 years in the United States. And so I think that those who might not have sensed that shift fully, you know, have leaned toward these, you know, potential first mover benefits of like, well, we could be the only daytime show on TV. Maybe that's
competitively,
worth,
that sounds really good.
Right? Maybe if that's worth alienating a few people. But I think they underestimated the strength and veracity of those folks who are feeling the other way and the solidarity that's really formed around a number of these different issues.
Yeah. And I think the reason for both the union organization and a lot of these strikes and the support for them it's a broader cultural thing. It's a reaction against the pulling apart of the middle class, the incredibly high salaries that CEOs and some very highly paid on-the-air talent are getting as compared to the worker bees who are doing the production. So I'm trying to imagine, like, if Drew Barrymore or Bill Maher went back on the air, when the strike's over, how are they going to be getting along with their writer's room, you know? And I think that probably came into play. But it's tone deaf.
Right.
Because you're getting highly compensated, and there are other people who can't afford. They're living in places, either New York or Los Angeles, that are very expensive. So I think it's a response to that and a good response.
Okay. So anyone who knows me knows I have a pretty eclectic musical taste, and Poor Luke is the faculty member who has the office next to me. And so he has unfortunately been having to listen to Nickelback for the last 2 days. And it's because of this story. It suddenly made me want to listen to Nickelback. It was about something that was in the New York Times, and I had to chuckle when I read the headline. Nickelback knows you hate them, and they want to talk about it. Back in the early 2000s, if you're not familiar, Nickelback got more radio airtime than any other band in North America. Only it was the band we all hated. Do you even know why? I didn't until I found this.
No one talks about the studies that show that bad music makes people violent. Like Nickelback makes me want to kill Nickelback.
That was from Brian Posehn, who you might recognize from The Big Bang Theory and The Sarah Silverman Show. That 10 seconds of video from the early 2000s. And now, all these years later, Nickelback is still a hit, drawing 10,000 people for a free show at the Toronto Film Festival. And that was 3.5 times as many people than were expected to attend. The band had their biopic documentary open at that festival. That's one of the reasons they had this free concert that all the people showed up to. One of the things that's really interesting, though, about this documentary, they commissioned it. Like, so this isn't like the big let's remember Nickelback with nostalgia that somebody decided we needed to have out there. They decided this needed to be out there.
So we've seen over the last couple of years this trend of looking back toward musicians from 10, 15, 20 years ago and reevaluating them, right? And so stories that I've read, you know, included Hootie and the Blowfish. I was certainly among the millions who bought Cracked Review in 1990, whenever that was, right? Sheryl Crow, our own University of Missouri's own Sheryl Crow, who I was a big fan of back in her early work.
If it makes you happy. Can't be that bad. Sorry, and I interrupted.
No, that's great. And, and I think that there's a lot of value for us culturally in thinking back and saying, well, how can we consider the ways in which these artists might have been slighted, right? And I have nothing wrong with that view looking back at Nickelback as well, thinking about them in that same way. It's just that maybe a little bit less meaningful when they're incentivizing it and paying for it themselves.
It ain't the last waltz. Okay, the band. Okay. So I'm going to show my boomerism here. I had no clue until you showed me this, but I do think it's kind of, I do think it's kind of funny and kind of cheekily
ironic. The Gen
Xers
over here having a moment.
Right, yeah, but I thought it was funny that they did this, and so that would raise them a little bit in my estimation that they were willing to take a satirical view of themselves.
Okay, well, so one of the reasons that everybody loved to hate Nickelback, to fill in some of those outside of our generation, all of their music sounds the same. That's what it ultimately comes down to. Like, they found a pattern and they just ran with it, album after album. That's not Nickelback you're hearing, but that music does mean we are out of time for this week. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of the topics we talked about on our links blog under the programs and the podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch, listen to the program again, leave comments, questions, see what we'll talk about next week, and more. Our thanks to Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to Kia Thomas for handling the audio, Tim Pilcher composed the theme music, and Nate Brown is our social media manager. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again next week.